be blue, 'cause I can't see you.
Hello, this is Richie Wexler. Welcome to Vintage Annals Archive, episode 83. We're about to hit 117 more episodes. Wow, that's all I can say. I'm really excited about today's guest, Ruth Ann Freeman. I first heard Ruth Ann's music probably about 15, 20 years ago. And it was kind of a mixture of like a lot of old folky stuff. She's part of the 60s scene. She hung out with Ken Kesey, Grateful Dead. She briefly lived with David Crosby in his apartment. Really interesting person. And then there's a bit of a trigger warning for the episode. Had a death in the family by suicide, and it kind of shifted her work for years and years until she kind of got back on the music horse, so to speak, and then made a really great album called Chinatown. But her really most famous early album was called Constant Companion, came out in 69, a really amazing album. So I got to really talk to Ruth Ann. What a very authentic, very real, genuine person, and it was really a pleasure. We did this a few months ago, and I'm really just excited to let people know about her who don't know. And please check out her music. Again, there's a few different albums around. But I recommend Windy is the song she's known for, but I recommend Constant Companion, and I recommend Chinatown. When I spoke to her, Chinatown was, to her, one of her favorite albums, and she'd worked with Van Dyke Parks, which is pretty cool. All right, thank you. I'm curious on some of the musicians when you were a kid that kind of got to you, that in terms of the, I don't know if it was just folk stuff or all over the place, but who were some of the people that you feel like, or even the songs that really, really did it to you when you were younger?
When I was growing up, my family listened to music all the time, but my father loved classical music and opera. So I heard a lot of that, grew up listening to Beethoven and Bach, and also Woody Guthrie, Josh White, A Voice Like Honey in Your Ear, show tunes. I can sing you all the songs from Guys and Dolls in Oklahoma and all of those. I used to dance up Gun Hill Road in the Bronx. I used to dance up the street to show tunes, hoping that somebody would find me and see this, you know, the talented, amazing 8-year-old, and take me away. Yes. So, and let's see. Not so much crooners or anything like that. I didn't grow up listening when I was really little. In my teenage years, I discovered Miles Davis and that kind of blew me away. I started playing guitar when I was 8, so I was always, you know, playing folk music. But you know, Pete Seeger and, like I said, Woody Guthrie, and but Miles Davis blew me away. That was it. Kind of blew me away.
Tell me about that. But I'm just curious on what that did to your mind, or
it opened it up. And also, I was a very unhappy teenager. My father was a very unhappy man himself. He died very young. He died when I was my first year in high school, and he and my mother just did not get along very well. And my brother and sister were both much older than I. My sister 10 years and my brother 6. And so by the time we moved to California when I was 10, they were gone. You know, they were in college and gone, and I bore the brunt of my parents' dislike of each other, put it this way. And I don't know why they stayed together. I guess those days you did, you know, there's a lot of family drama going on. So I was not a very happy teenager. And my big escape was to be in my room, whatever that was. I was always in the little room on the other side of the house, the maid's room in the family. Anyway, that's another story. I was sitting there playing guitar from the Firestone Book of Folk Songs and Richard Dreyer Bennett folk books and things like that. And that was my big escape. By the time I was 15, 16, and able to go to Music City at Sunset and Vine and buy records, I found Miles Davis, and that, I don't know how, it just opened my heart more than anything, because he talked to my, because it spoke to my pain. That Kind of Blue, those songs, that melody spoke to me in a way that nothing had before. Those notes, just amazing, wonderful stuff.
In doing a little research, it talked about, there's a review of your Chinatown album, and it talked about it being kind of jazzy. And I'm wondering, even in creating more folk music, was jazz an influence in there somewhere?
Yes. And if you listen to Chinatown, some of it is jazz, I think.
Right. That's right. That's why I kind of, yeah.
Some of it is definitely jazz. I'm not a brilliant musician. I'm just, I find my way on the guitar. I just heard my good friend Rachel Goodrich last night. I don't know if you've ever heard her stuff.
I don't, no.
Oh, amazing. You've got to hear Rachel. Google Rachel Goodrich. She's an amazing guitarist, brilliant. And I learn a lot from her, and I get to noodle with her. But the two of us love Bill Evans, and that's Bill Evans is also just an enormous influence. I've been listening to him. Peter Kalkinen introduced me to Bill Evans back in the 60s. And oh my God, what an amazing pianist. Just brilliant.
All I can say to you is, in listening to your music, maybe musically I don't know. I mean, I can't tell that you're not good in the guitar or great, but your voice makes up for it, in my opinion. Your voice, I mean, voice is an instrument, so your voice is.
I never think of myself that way. I think of myself more as a songwriter than as a singer. But yeah, thank you. I try.
I want to take this a little chronologically, but not perfectly. I'm just curious on. Even if Judaism isn't important for you, did it play out being a Jew in New York, being born around World War II? Has being Jewish been something you've thought about in your life in any way? Whether it's, you know, for me, like, again, I'm not religious, I don't believe in God, but being Jewish and the ideals I was taught are very important. I'm just curious if you fall into that at all.
Taking you across my living room, okay? I'm moving the phone so that you can see what is on my table here. I don't know if I can organize this so you can see it. Can you see it?
I can see the flag.
The flag.
Nice.
Okay, and to me, being Jewish is not religion, it's culture. And I'm just so upset about what's going on in the world right now. And I am so upset that there's a statistic I recently heard is that if it had not been for the Holocaust, there would now be 250 million Jews in the world. There are 15 million Jews left in the world. And in my history, I'm sure as you are as well, is that I lost 3/4 of my family in Auschwitz. And I tear up and I feel physically ill when I think about that. And they know what's going on now. I was going to put that flag out in front of my house. We had a Ukrainian flag up for a long time. It finally fell down. But you know, my husband and I discussed it, and we're afraid to. We're afraid to put the flag out in front of our house. And I live in Venice, California. I mean, I'm not, you know, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but I'm afraid to.
Let's go into music. It seemed like the one of the your big moments in what I've read about was Rocket to Stardom. You were 12, correct?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
I didn't win. Somebody wrote down there that I won. Oh, no, I did not win. Rocket to Stardom with Bob and Betty Yakult had an Oldsmobile dealership, and they had a TV show that was on weekends, and they had, you know, just, and my daddy took me in my pink and white gingham dress with a big petticoat. We all wore these enormous petticoats at the time, were popular in the 50s. You know, you see pictures of women and their skirts are out to there. Anyway, and took me to play. And I think I sang a Harry Belafonte song. He was somebody that I loved a lot too. I listened to Harry Belafonte a lot when I was a teenager, young, when I was preteen.
So it seems like, you know, just musically, it seemed like that was the moment that was mentioned. And then it seemed like you got involved with Hoot Nights at the Troubadour. It mentioned Steve Mann, Hoyt Axton. Tell me about, you know, you going, and I guess you were around 16 at this time when you're playing out, when you're in the scene.
So I graduate, well, high school, I was the president of the Folk Song Club. That was a big deal. So when I graduated from high school, we started smoking weed and started hanging out with musicians such as Bad Girl, Steve Mann. Have you ever heard of Steve Mann? Steve Mann was one of the best blues guitarists ever. And if you talk to people like, you know, Jorma Kaukonen and, you know, people who you do know, and you say, mention the name Steve Mann, they will tell you that he had these enormous hands. He could do a 10 fret stretch. He was just brilliant. And he was a big influence on me. He taught me to finger pick. And we used to go to this club, he and I, called the Fifth Estate. In fact, that's where I got high the first time. I was 18. And we go to the Fifth Estate, and he would play, and I would sing things like, "Ain't nobody gonna get none of my jelly roll," or "Evil hearted, evil as a woman can be." I'm like 18 years old. I go, "Evil, don't even care. It rains from now on, and the man I love had never been born." Evil. Anyway, so Steve Mann and I hung out a lot. Went to the Troubadour, played Hoot Nights. You could get served beer down the street at Barney's Beanery.
Ruth Ann, drinking and smoking pot?
No, I never liked alcohol. Didn't start liking alcohol till I was much older. But yeah, smoking pot, yeah, boy, it opened up my brain. And then Bob Dylan. Oh, and then my friend Tim Blanton came back from New York City with a Bob Dylan album. And oh my God, you know, what the? What is going on here? Something happening here, you know? So Steve Mann and I hung out a lot, and Steve Mann introduced me to Van Dyke Parks, and Van Dyke introduced me to a lot of people, Danny Hutton and even Kim Fowley, who's, may he rest in peace.
Well, tell me about, I mean, I don't know. I know he was a musician. I know he was a manager of Runaways. Tell me about, he's a character. Tell me about him, if you don't mind.
I walked into Van Dyke's apartment over on Melrose Avenue, around the corner from Pink's Hot Dogs, where you could get a decent meal for 35 cents at the time. And I walked in, and this very tall, redheaded man was stretched out, recumbent, stretched out full length on the couch. And he looked at me and he said, "It's all about your attitude." Oh, that's what makes it. It's your attitude. So he was renowned for kind of ripping people off, or, you know, being, yeah, he was a character, quite a character. I saw him last, I think Van Dyke was playing at the record store in Hollywood. Van Dyke was playing, and Danny Hutton was playing, and Kim Fowley was there, and I hadn't seen him in 30 years, you know. And I ran into him at a party once at the Church of Fashion, and just an interesting character. He liked to direct the scene. He liked to make people dance, you know.
Let's get back to Van Dyke Parks. Tell me about meeting him, your friendship. You know, we can talk about him for a little bit. I'm curious on...
I love Van Dyke. I loved him. He entered the association where I ended up living with them shortly thereafter. I was, you know, a homeless waif. I always relied on the kindness of strangers. Well, Van Dyke and I had a lot of fun together for about a year. And then he met Dury and got married, and that was the end of our relationship, needless to say. But he got me to, he introduced me to Tommy LaPuma. I'm trying to think of, oh no, way before that. Let's back up. Okay, there was a fellow from Atlanta, Georgia named Steve Clark. And he was, dizzy. Steve Clark out of Atlanta had a little stable of singer-songwriters. Kurt Betcher, who you may have heard of. No? All right, Kurt Betcher. Tandon Almer wrote Along Comes Mary. Yeah, Tandon Almer, another genius. Crazy as a coot, but a genius. So we recorded, I'm like 19, 20. And we recorded on Hudson Street. I can't remember the guy's name. It was Skip and Flip. I'm very bad with names. Cord downstairs around a microphone. It was all one track. And we'd go upstairs to listen back. Anyway, some of the songs on are on the CD that Steve Stanley did, Ruth Ann Friedman, A Windy Songbook, Ruth Ann Friedman, yeah, that one. There's some real bad stuff on that. It's embarrassing, but it's history, you know, so he insisted on putting it there. So some of that's on there, me trying to be something other than me. Me trying to write commercial, what they wanted me to write, you know, and sing. And I can't sing that way. I'm not a blues. I'm not a, I don't know what I am. I'm not that kind of a singer. And I was with him for about a year, I guess. And he paid my rent, which was really nice. And about that time I met Stephen Stills and Neil Young and,
Okay, I have to ask you about Neil Young. Neil Young is a favorite of mine. What was it?
Okay, when Neil Young and his group friends came down from Canada, they were staying. Dickie Davis, I think, was managing them at the time. I can't remember what they called themselves, but they were all staying in one room in a motel, this crappy motel on Sunset Boulevard. There's my baby. And Neil got sick. So he needed to be taken care of. So they brought him to my little single place and I put him to bed. We never had any kind of, you know, we were friends.
I'm assuming you're not going to hit on Neil Young while he's sick.
Well, no, I didn't hit on people. I waited for them to hit on me. I was not that aggressive. But at that time, people actually still did do that when you're in your 20s, you know.
Let me ask you about David Crosby, because I know you live with him. I know what I read, it's that you had composed Windy at his house. I'm just curious on, it seemed like maybe you had a longer, did you have a different kind of relationship or more intense with David versus Neil?
David Crosby had a house in Beverly Glen, right behind the Beverly Glen Market, where I ironically, it had been my first place that I rented on my own for $65 a month at the time, I think. Was right next door to that. But anyway, he had an apartment underneath his house. I mean, the fourth floor was his apartment, and he invited me to stay there. And that's where I wrote Windy. And then I never had to stay on anybody's couch again, ever.
Tell me about writing Windy. It says there's some guy who came in who kind of gave you a weird look, and then you thought about, I'm just curious, on I don't want to tell the story for you, but...
Sitting and waiting for me to do something. I don't know. It was, you know...
Just weird.
He ended up, I forget his name, but he ended up with a billboard on Sunset Boulevard. So he did okay by himself. But I was just, you know, noodling. It took me 20 minutes to write the song. It just came out. Sometimes they come out whole, you know, don't have any birth pains at all. It just, they pop right out. And that was one of them, Windy. And then the association, and I had lived with Jules and Jimmy Yester and Jules Alexander. I had lived in their house, and Jimmy's then wife, Jo Ellen, called and asked if I had any songs. And I said, well, I just wrote this one song and I played it for them and they recorded it within the week and called me up to come and sing on the fade because they were sure it was going to be a hit. And coincidentally, at the same time, Wendy was on the radio being a hit.
And thinking about Wendy, you know, part of what we try to do here is get people to tell stories, which you're greatly doing. Was there anything in that whole path of Wendy that's, you know, something you want to share, any kind of odd story related to just...
Wendy became a girl, and I had forgotten that Wendy was a boy at first. I really had... Wendy really with me, I think. Idealized moment at a time of great trauma in our country, what was going on in the country with a lot of pain and Vietnam and terrible, and everybody needed a little bubblegum pop, a little hope. You know, I feel the same way now, man. It's just terrible times, just terrible, terrible times, and I don't know what to do about it. I've written a song that's on that on Chinatown CD, the tides, you know, will history tell how we rose and we fell, you know, it's hard, hard. I was born in a time when this country was an ideal. We idealized ourselves because there was still a lot of, you know, with the United Fruit Company and all that stuff going on in South America, there's a lot of bad stuff going on, but we were the good guys. We thought of ourselves as the good guys. And I grew up thinking that. And then the 60s came and bang, you know, all of a sudden, hey, we're not such good guys. You know, think about it. Do you want to talk about the Palestinians? How about we talk about the indigenous American people? I was going to say before, I was saying when Wendy was a hit on the radio, also a song that I recorded called Little Girl Lost and Found, which was a Tandon Almer song, and he wrote Along Comes Mary for the Association. You know that song. Okay. I recorded that, and that was a hit on the local hit. And I got my contract with A&M, and I recorded a lot of stuff for A&M because of that song. That song, they wanted me to cover. They released it under the name of the Garden Club, and I sang all the parts except for one. Oh God, what's his name? Wonderful singer, songwriter. Anyway, who sang one part? So at the time that Wendy was a hit on the radio, there was also the Association singing my song. It was me singing Tandon's song. It was also a local hit, and my mother who. You know, had two successful children. My brother's a doctor. My brother's my son, the doctor. And then my sister had just sold a script to Marty Ranzahoff in Hollywood. So she was successful. And my mother tells of being in the car with my sister and they were driving somewhere. And the song came on the radio. My mother could then say, all three of my children are now are okay. They're going to be okay, which is a good thing.
Does that put you in the black sheep? Does that put you in the black sheep category of
Oh, I've always been a black sheep.
me as well.
Yeah, I was a bad girl.
I don't know about that. Let's get into Constant Companion, because it seems like that, you know, that album really seemed like it opened up your world. When, you know, what was the process for working on that? When did you decide you wanted to make an album?
Okay, the Van Dyke again got me to Mo Austin and Lenny Walker at the Warner Brothers, which ironically, Warner Brothers Records is in the same building that used to house Warner Television, which is where my sister was working. So I go into this building. Well, my sister. It's a really weird circle here. So I signed with them. Van Dyke brought Joe Wizard up to, I was house sitting my sister in Beverly Hills, brought Joe Wizard up to meet me. Joe Wizard produced Constant Companion. And he had done, he was famous for producing some rock bands. I don't remember who. Anyway, so that was, he wanted it. He wanted it pure. He wanted just me and guitar. I went over with Kirby Johnson begging to, you know, do something other than just me and guitar on it, and he would not hear of it. I had a trunk full of albums and was traveling around the United States going to radio stations promoting it myself. I got to Reno, Nevada, and got a phone call that my sister had killed herself. And that just everything, you know, left the car. I think if I had been greatly successful, if I had, you know, made it big in the big time, I don't know if I'd be alive today, because drugs were a very big problem. Joni Mitchell and I drove up to the Big Sur Folk Festival together in 1968. She gave me half of her set. It didn't make it onto the video. I've been trying to get a hold of that. Maybe somebody has that footage, but apparently it's gone with the wind. She gave me half of her set the second day. She brought me up on stage and said to my friend Ruth Ann Friedman, and I got back three songs that got great reviews, Rolling Stone and in LA. I got great reviews, and that was that.
Were you friendlier with her, with Joni? But, or if not, I'm just curious, like, what is...
We were acquainted. We weren't pals or anything, no.
And just to back up a second, you were in Petrus, right, with Peter, who you were married to, Peter Kalkin. You were married to Peter, right?
No, we were married, no.
Who were you married? There was someone they mentioned you were married to that was a musician for a few years.
Jeffrey, the only marriage I've had. I lived with Alan Wayne for like 5 years.
Okay, I'm sorry. But
Peter and I lived together for, I don't know, a year and a half.
Maybe it said lived together. I assumed you were married. I'm sorry.
Peter came down when I was still living in David Crosby's house. And Peter, I called Yorma because I had had a relationship with Yorma up in San Francisco. And when I was up there living with Yorma and Marty Fallon in my San Francisco incarnation. And I said, A&M wants me to put together a band to cover this Tandon Almer song, Little Girl Lost and Found. I need a guitarist. And he said, well, my brother's available. He was at Stanford at the time. So he came down and we hit it off. And I went back with him up to Palo Alto. And we ended up getting a house in Half Moon Bay up on a hill and recruited a drummer and a bass player and had a band. So I had a band called Petrus.
Does that exist anywhere? I couldn't find any mentions of the album, or
there's a couple of songs on that the Steve Stanley Wendy's songbook. Sky is Moving South is one. Peter wrote songs that he just do the changes, and I'd have to find the melody, and his changes were so weird that it was really hard for me to sing those songs. So when I hear him back, I go, oh my god, my voice. But there were some interesting songs. We had a house. After we left Half Moon Bay, we rented a house in Malibu, one of those, you know, right on the water, little tiny place. And so we wrote songs about what we were seeing out this big picture window that looked at the ocean. You know, the sky is moving south was one song, and another was the chocolate sea, because with that terrible storm and all the dirt would go into the water and it was like brown, the sea. So we wrote some good songs. And we recorded for A&M too. Petrus recorded for A&M, but nothing happened.
I want to shift to you going, that you went to school. I think you studied writing or literature. I want to hear about that end of your life, like writing. And did you go to school to be a teacher or just to study literature, or wasn't super clear what you went to school for?
I was a miserable student in high school. I was very unhappy, obviously. My daddy died, and even though he was a fucking lunatic and very mean to me. It still was a very traumatic thing. So I was miserable through high school. I barely graduated. And my brother and sister were stellar students. My sister went to the University of Chicago at the age of 15, you know, had her master's degree by the time she was 20. My brother, UCLA at the age of 16, University of Chicago Medical School, you know, they were there. And me, I was like hanging on. I was definitely a disappointment to my parents scholastically. So back in about the year 2000, I decided I'm not doing music anymore. I got to do something. And I went back to school and I ended up at UCLA getting a bachelor's degree at 2003. And I am very proud to say I graduated magna cum laude with honors both in departmental and, it validated me in ways that I needed to, because I had been such a crappy student, that I wasn't a stupid head. I was, you know, I had something, my brain worked. But I also got to read a lot of poetry. I was major in poetry. And that is why you will see the difference between the songs that I wrote in my 20s and the songs that I wrote in my 60s.
What made you kind of shift from 30 years absence to going back to playing music?
Pat Thomas called me because at Water Records, they heard my album and they wanted to reissue it. And that's what started it. I had not played the guitar, you know, except for my kid's nursery school for years. You know, I wrote the Dinosaur Song and We Are a Circle of Friends of the Bay City Jewish Community Center Nursery School. And so I went to Kit Alderson at McCabe's Guitar Center, who had been my daughter's guitar teacher, who helped me relearn my songs. I didn't even know how to play them anymore. And he was brilliant. He could listen to anything. And then once he got me started, the muscle memory came back and a lot, but I did not remember how to play my own songs. I still don't. I'd have to go back and look at the notation that he made. So their reissue of Constant Companion is what got me going again. And I write songs in clusters. There are a cluster of songs that I wrote right after Constant Companion was re-released. Some of them I don't think ever got released at all. There's one called Circles that's kind of cute. And anyway, so I write clusters and then I don't write. I haven't written anything for a long, long time now. I noodle all the time and I write it down, but it never becomes a song anymore.
Yeah. I think I feel like we're kind of conduits for the universe. I mean, I don't believe in God, but I believe in magic. I believe in universe communicating. I believe in, like, when you put an idea out to the universe, it answers and it's done that. And sometimes the universe, you have a direct link to it. Sometimes you don't. You just got to milk it when you have it, you know?
I understand. And I do believe in magic and I don't believe in magic. I do and I don't. I'm very open-minded about that, but I do not believe in the magic man in the sky. Magic is when that blade of grass forces its way up through the cement. That's magic.
You said to me that Chinatown was the album you're most proud of. Tell me about making it. Tell me about, you know, it seems like you learned to be a better writer from your study of poetry. Tell me about Chinatown. Well, why is it your best?
A better writer because of my getting an education or being more exposed to more. I've always read. I've been a big reader my whole life, but never thought very critically about it. And I think that's what a good education does, is it teaches you to think critically. And unfortunately, not that many people do think critically. They don't examine. And thinking critically makes it more difficult to write, because the critic is always on your shoulder, you know. now it has to be the right word, and we want to take in all the ways it could be interpreted and all of that sort of thing. And the imagination comes into it, and you know, like daring to say, I have this one lyric, I'm going home. Don't try to stop me now. I'll have to knock it right down. You know, but at first I said, I can't write that in a song. And I said, yes, I can. And I did. So that kind of thing. I don't know where it comes from. It can be a very painful process. It can be a very difficult process. And maybe that's why I'm not doing it at the moment. You have to be very strict with yourself, I think. I go through periods of time where I do different things. I started doing these drawings, very fine line, tiny little point on a pen, drawings that sort of abstract, and then it got into color. I had a show a couple of years ago, and doing that, and then I burn out on it. And I did bead work, crocheting with little tiny glass beads, and I did that for about a year. I have lots of hat bands I made, and everybody got a hat band or a bracelet or something. I go through different periods of time where I need to do something with my hands, you know. Recently, I've been playing more guitar because my friend Rachel is here. She's from Miami, but she's here now. She's actually going back on Monday. So I play with her, and playing with her gets me going again.
Have those, and in terms of your world, even, I don't know now, like are there certain drugs that you like to do that are beneficial for your mind, or, you know,
psychedelic drugs?
Yeah. Psychedelic or pot. I mean, are there things that really that you've like that do well for you?
I still smoke pot.
Nice.
For a while I was smoking too much. Now I do, you know, every few nights, and I'll have a hit music with friends, like music.
Yeah.
LSD, peyote, all kinds of other weird drugs. Ketamine, I had.
How was ketamine. What was that? What was ketamine like?
Tranquilizer, just bizarre stuff that we do. We took everything. You open your mouth and pop it in. Yes, it taught me about the universe. It taught me that the rules that I had been living by, that I had been, that my parents had tried to instill in me, were bullshit. As any anthropology student, you take social anthropology and you realize there are many different ways of being a society. You know, not everybody thinks that that bigamy is a bad thing. You know what I mean? So there are many different ways of being, and that ours is not necessarily the right way. It's just the way we have evolved, what we evolved into, and that you don't have to take their rules and take the rules and shove it. Here's one story I don't think I've told anybody before, that Jack Cassidy dosed me with acid at a backstage at a Jefferson Airplane concert in Mill Valley. That son of a bitch dosed me. He asked me if I wanted a glass of wine. I said, sure, Jack. And I should have known better. I should have known. It really screwed me. Ah.
It's interesting because you were a child of the 50s, but you were a teen in the 60s. And I feel like whenever I think about really radical thinking, I feel like it comes more from the 50s and drug use than it does from the 60s.
I don't know. Kerouac and all those people, the Bohemians, but then Kerouac and crew, right? The Beatniks came, and they weren't taking LSD. They were drinking and smoking weed. That's what they were doing.
But I'm talking more culturally. It seemed like jazz really built the counterculture before the 60s.
That's true.
And I think we don't.
They were smoking weed, but they were shooting heroin, you know?
Right. I just think we don't really look at that counterculture starting in the 50s, but I feel like when you look at that, without that time, I don't think you get to the 60s in counterculture, because I feel like people don't really talk about the 50s being the start of the counterculture. And I feel like if you didn't have that, you wouldn't have gotten to the 60s counterculture. I feel like that built the seeds.
Right. I think that that song, that that's what I remember, which is the first song at Chinatown. It's a reading on the road at a very tender age. I was just 13, and how I love to break the rules. That on the road opened that up for me. You're right. I'm thinking about that, absolutely. Because if it hadn't been for On the Road, I don't think I would have.
You know, I mean, my last trip, it changed my entire life in a way that I never would have thought about. But I also took enough for like 5 people by accident.
That's a lot of shrooms, man. I have a friend in Oregon who sends me shrooms. Sometimes you need to shake it up and change your perspective. I have a tendency to be very, very depressed. My father tried to kill himself his first year in California. My sister succeeded. You know, so a familial history of depression, and I fight it every fucking day. I am fighting. That's why I get up at 6 in the morning and watch the sunrise, so I can, you know. And I have beautiful grandchildren, and I wouldn't want I. You know, I don't mind dying, but I hate to leave my children crying. I just couldn't do that. Having gone through it with my sister, I could not do that to my children and grandchildren. I couldn't do it. It would be just, you know, you just got to keep on. Well, I keep on telling my friends and beloved people lately, the last few weeks, it came to me that when I'm walking that walk, to keep the love in your heart. All this bad stuff is happening all around us, but you look at the people that you care about and you keep the love in your heart, and that keeps us going, because we all need it. When I walk on this walk, it's become very much a part of my life. I had a hip replacement in a year ago, and subsequently I had bleeding, ulcer almost died, I had COVID, anyways, I started doing this walk about last January, and I do it every day, except I miss a couple. And every day I see a lot of the same people. Good morning, how are you today? And play with their puppies. And you know, there's this one old man who walks all the old ladies back and forth. George, we all love George. And it's reaching other people and touching, being able to say, you know, good morning, have a good day. Somebody, I'm a human being on this earth with you, and I care that you are here too. And I want you to know that I am, you know, I'm with you. We're together in this pickle that we're in. And it's really very meaningful to me. And when they're, give me a smile. You know, it fills your heart. I'm a cornball.
I'm really glad we got talking. I'm going to let you go. And it was a pleasure meeting you. And just, yeah, I'll reach out. But let me know if you're playing somewhere and I can promote it. If you're ever touring in Philly, I'll take, you know, I'll show you around.
Is there anything I can do to?
Oh, I wanted you to play some music. I wanted you to play some. Yeah. Do you? Yeah, I forgot about that. No, we have.
You
yeah,
want me to? I
would love you to. How many?
I tune my guitar and everything.
Let's just play Chinatown. There we go. Thank you so much.
Chinatown in the rain melts the guilt off the dragon scale. Any shame that remains is a mystery. Such a shady parade winds along through the alleyways. Any light that pervades is a mystery. There is no reason, only rhyme. The goddess who waste of time. Chinatown in the rain, curls of smoke through a crimson door. Any dreams you maintain are a mystery, a mystery. There is no reason, only rhyme. The goddess filled with wasted time. Chinatown in the rain melts the guilt off the dragon's scale. Any shame that remains is a mystery, a mystery. It's a mystery, a mystery. It's a mystery, a mystery.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much, Ruthann. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for checking this out. I gotta say, looking kind of down the list of all the guests we've had a lot of focus on music or musicians in different aspects. And I'm very proud. I mean, I've been a long, long life music fan. Still am. But I really like that there's such a focus on musicians. We just put an episode out with Paul Williams again. We just did a big series based on the musical How to Dance in Ohio. I'm just going to go down and kind of read some other ones that I feel like are music related. We just did one about Taylor Mack, who does these great drag-inspired arts. It's hard to describe it. It's drag and kind of performance art, really great, amazing stuff. I can't do it justice. There's a lot here. We just did one with Dan Fishback a while ago, who's a musician. I'm just going to keep scrolling a little bit. Dean Freeman is one of my favorite kind of outsider musicians, in my opinion. We did an episode with Dave Gebro and Paul Major, who's one of the most known music collectors of his generation. We did one with Damon Devine, who was a caregiver of Ima Sumac. Music. We did an episode of the folks who put the music together for a show that I did a deep separate podcast, Minx. We interviewed some of the people involved with the soundtrack. We interviewed Jolie Klausner, who wrote for Schmigadoon. Mojo Nixon, Kylan Lunsford, local musician, going to be famous one day. Perry Schau, music is a big part of his life. He does a lot of really great design work. Amos Poe documented no wave and punk scene. We're going to put out one soon on Julie Gordon, who also did the same work. It's essentially, Ann Magison has a lot of music in her background. Dead Milkmen, Eddie Davis, who performed my bar mitzvah in '83. I love that story. It's about his life. Tracy Guns was the original founders of Guns N' Roses, and then LA Guns. We did another with Paul Williams, B.J. Snowden, who does the song most of the episodes. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of music in here. So that's it. Check it out. Share it. Enjoy. VintageAnimalsArchive.com, VintageAnimalsArchive Instagram. And this one will also be in the Jewish project, Jewish Vintage Animals Archive. And we have a separate podcast for that as well, which this will be on the main one and the Jewish one. Thought indifferent.